America, because so many of his fellow service members paid the ultimate price. So it's thanks to the soldiers, the sailors, the airmen, the guardians who fought fascism alongside so many of your relatives. That's the reason we have democracy here at home now. I spent my weekend watching democracy in practice. I had town hall meetings. People can just say anything they want, whether they're left, center, wherever they are, they say whatever they want. And I thought in much of the world, they don't have meetings like that, folks. People don't get to say what's on their mind in much of the world. So the people we remember every day sacrifice their lives, their futures, their dreams, so that all of us could have the freedoms I saw the last couple days, the freedoms of speech, the freedoms of assembly. And I'll close by putting it in the context of what Cliff and I deal with back in D.C. Back in D.C., people talk a lot about, throw around the words war and battle, and I guess that passes for differences of opinion in D.C. And yes, there are big differences of opinion. But I'll tell you, and I'm sure Cliff feels this way too, the wars and battles of politics don't compare to the actual deadly war and battles that your loved ones went through far from home. And they didn't go to war as Democrats or Republicans. They went to war for all of us as Americans. It's their sacrifices that let us gather where we want, when we want, and make sure it's free to all of us to say what we want. That is an amazing legacy, an incredible legacy, and one that so many paid for dearly on battlefields. So as we remember loved ones, you have our empathy and sympathy for your loss. You've got our thanks because our country and state are safer because of those values. It's a tremendous honor to represent Oregon in the United States Congress, but there is no bigger honor, none, than representing our service members and our Gold Star families in the United States Senate. And I think about that every day. So let us say, as we think about those we've lost, we walk through the cemetery. I had a chance to do that already. We're always going to remember the sacrifices of our loved ones, that they're never forgotten. And every day, Cliff and I have the opportunity in Washington to champion the needs of our service members, veterans, families, and supporters. And we will do it not because it's about politics, but because we're Americans.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, May 29th, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem, Isabel Charlet, and Suzanne Potter. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, just go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In-Depth, up next.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov. I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the week. In this week's report, I start off with several news items that reveal a U.S. government and president out of control. Charging white genocide in South Africa, threatening more high tariffs, proposing the use of foreign aid to repatriate foreigners, engaging in cryptocurrency corruption. First, Trump's false charge of white genocide in South Africa. Trump once again is engaging in reverse racism, charging that an oppressor class is the victim. In this case, it's white South Africans who are the supposed victims of genocide, on the strength of nothing more than a frenzied white lobbyist who got Trump's ear. It started with giving these Afrikaners special immigration status to emigrate to the U.S., at the same time that the administration is systematically removing Venezuelans, Haitians, and others from the U.S. Trump is also pressuring the South African government of Cyril Ramaphosa, who recently visited Washington, to change its racial equity laws. As usual, Trump ignores South Africa's history of apartheid and mixes acts of violence against Afrikaners with genocide to intervene with deliberate ignorance in another country's affairs. He showed Ramaphosa a video intended to prove black-on-white violence, but in fact it was a lurid scene taken in the Democratic Republic of Congo, not in South Africa. A South African journalist offered this view in the New York Times, quote, "Contrary to the claims in Mr. Trump's order, there is no evidence that the civil rights of white South Africans have been systematically trampled on, or that white landowners face disproportionate violence. They own farms that occupy about half of South Africa's area, despite making up around 7% of the population. No white-owned land or home has been forcibly taken by the government under a new land law mentioned in Mr. Trump's order." Unquote. Trump's demands were doubtless inspired by Elon Musk, who wanted his Starlink communication system to be adopted in his home country. U.S. aid to South Africa, including aid to fight HIV, has been cut off, high tariffs have been imposed on South African exports to the U.S., and a South African ambassador has been expelled. Trump also reportedly wanted South Africa to change a law that forces U.S. and other multinational corporations to allow black South Africans to buy equity in them. Trump's pressure tactics worked. Just days after Ramaphosa left for home, the Starlink system was adopted, and the law requiring black South African investment in them was overturned. Next, Trump threatens to resume the tariff war. He lashed out at the European Union and said he would apply a 50% tariff to European exports, starting in just over a week. A few days later, he reversed himself on the tariffs, postponing them and saying that he was open to negotiations. Perhaps he was influenced by estimates like this one from the Kiel Institute for the World Economy, a German economic research institute, which showed that the tariffs would lead to a 20% drop in exports from the European Union to the U.S. in the short term, as well as more than 6% increase in prices in the U.S. By one count, Trump has reversed himself on tariffs over 50 times. A third example of Trump out of control, his use of foreign aid to repatriate foreigners. Don't remind the Trump administration that it has cut foreign aid to the bone. Seems there's enough to use to get rid of Ukrainian, Haitian, and other migrant populations in the U.S., sending them home to appalling conditions with money that's supposed to be used for humanitarian assistance. That idea is in the works, using $250 million to return migrants to their country of origin, even if the country is in a conflict zone. Oh, if an immigrant self-deports home, then he or she will get $1,000 from Homeland Security. Ukrainians and Haitians aren't the only people who might be affected. The Washington Post, which has seen the plan, says a draft also mentions Afghans, Libyans, Sudanese, Syrians, and Yemenis. My fourth example, the crypto president's corruption. Donald Trump continues to make money by trading on his office. His recent private dinner for mainly foreign investors in his meme coin added millions more to his coffers, while at the same time exposing the presidency to foreign influence. The New York Times published a list of the attendees, about three-fourths of whom were from abroad, mostly of Chinese origin. All expressed a fawning admiration for Trump. Senator Mark Kelly is seeking to end crypto corruption, according to a Senate bill he is co-sponsoring. The bill would ban the president, vice president, and their immediate families from, quote, issuing, endorsing, or sponsoring crypto assets. The bill specifically names meme coins, which would present an issue for this president, whose controversial meme coin, $Trump, sends about 75% of its revenue to his family. Kelly took direct shots at Trump while publicizing the bill, writing in a press release, quote, "Trump is cashing in on his presidency and making millions from his own crypto coins. This is corruption in broad daylight." The press release also pointed out that the Trump family's net worth has increased by $2.9 billion as a result of his crypto investments. which Kelly now says make up nearly 40% of his wealth. Bills like these that seek to name and shame Trump's grifting don't have a ghost of a chance of being passed while Republicans rule the roost. In other news, reason for some optimism about U.S.-Iran talks. Writing in the New York Review, Christopher de Bellaigue believes conditions are ripe for a grand bargain. The axis of resistance, Hezbollah, Syria, and Iran, has been weakened by Israel's warfare and the fall in Syria of Bashar al-Assad. The Saudis want a U.S.-Iran detente and reject attacking Iran. And while Israel remains the outlier, Trump wants a deal, even one that merely restores the terms of the 2015 nuclear deal. And he's in a position to override Prime Minister Netanyahu, who would like nothing better than a green light to attack Iran. Finally, Iran itself is in dire straits, as de Bellaigue reports, quote, salaries are paid using the revenue from heavily discounted oil sales to China, and goods are bought from a variety of sources. In many cases, sanctions are circumvented with costly, inefficient, and corrupt methods that benefit a few at the expense of the many. Popular discontent finds expression in millions of women not wearing the mandatory hijab, and a rumble of protests against quotidian government failures, ranging from water shortages to pollution and power outages caused by shortages of the natural gas with which Iran is so abundantly endowed. The now-ousted finance minister in Iran said 10 million Iranians had fallen below the poverty line. Iran reportedly has proposed a very interesting approach to resolving the nuclear issue. The proposal is to establish a three-country nuclear consortium, including the U.S. and two Arab countries, in which Iran would enrich uranium to a low grade, beneath that needed for nuclear weapons, and then ship it to other Arab countries for civilian use. The low enrichment idea is the same one adopted in the 2015 nuclear deal that President Obama negotiated. But the addition of three countries to oversee the deal is new. No further news has come out on how this proposal has fared. U.S. support of international exchange programs may end. The Trump administration's slash-and-burn approach to government includes this item. Its fiscal year 2026 budget request proposes to cut State Department international exchange programs by $691 million, or 93%. Given the current budget is $741 million, this would leave only $50 million for all Bureau of Educational and Cultural Affairs programs and operations. Part and parcel of these budget cuts is Trump's war on Harvard. Not only is Trump seeking to end Harvard's tax-exempt status and cut off federal funding of Harvard research programs, his latest move terminates certification of Harvard's foreign student enrollments, forcing international students to go elsewhere. That means about 6,700 students are affected, or more than a quarter of Harvard's student body. The rationale provided by Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem is almost laughable. She linked Harvard not just to anti-Semitism, but also to support of terrorism and the Chinese Communist Party. And she warned that other schools better watch out, or the same shutdown will happen to them. Harvard's response was to condemn the move as unlawful, saying it is, quote, fully committed to maintaining Harvard's ability to host international students and scholars who hail from more than 140 countries and enrich the university and this nation immeasurably. The university is suing to block the administration's action. Serbia's pro-democracy protests continue. Serbia's far-right, nationalist, and authoritarian movement, once led by Slobodan Milosevic, returned to power in 2014 with the election of Aleksandar Vučić as prime minister. Since then, Serbia has experienced a democratic backsliding of the sort seen in Turkey and Hungary. The European Union has tolerated the eclipsing of press freedom, judicial independence, and civil society in Serbia because the economy has been reasonably productive and political stability has been maintained. But now, with the ruling party dominant in Serbian society to an exceptional degree, the opposition boycotted elections last year. One Serbian political scientist classifies the country as a semi-consolidated autocracy. The student-led protest that began last November was sparked by the collapse of a train station, killing 14 people. This happened despite repeated repairs to the station. Collusion between the government and contractors is said to be responsible. By the end of 2024, This spontaneous protest had gained support from all state universities and some private ones. Now many towns and cities have joined the protest, which is marked by nonviolence and political inclusiveness. The protesters are demanding a return to the rule of law, accountable institutions, and direct democracy whenever possible. Snap elections are being called for universities and their faculties under direct threat from the government, in much the same way as here. Police and judges are under pressure to get tougher with the protesters. EU groups are now for the first time taking notice of this backsliding, and they're siding with the protesters. That puts Serbia's government on the spot, since it seeks EU membership. The outcome of this struggle is uncertain, but the far-right ruling party is under greater threat than ever before. Next, bizarre events in Philippines politics. Politics in the Philippines these days is a family affair. You're either affiliated with the family of current President Ferdinand Marcos Jr. or with the family of his predecessor, Rodrigo Duterte, and his daughter, Sara Duterte, who happens to be the vice president and faces an impeachment trial. In midterm elections for half the seats in the 24-member Senate just concluded, Marcos's allies lost support to Duterte's allies, making it likely that Sara Duterte will be able to avoid conviction. In another sign of Duterte's reemergence as a political force, he won election as mayor, even though he is incarcerated in the Netherlands, pending trial before the International Criminal Court on charges of crimes against humanity for his brutal war on drugs while he was president. A reset in Britain-EU relations. Britain reached a wide-ranging deal with the European Union, including a security and defense pact, and fewer restrictions on British food exporters and visitors. The agreement should boost the United Kingdom's economy on the agricultural side, since there will be fewer regulations, making food cheaper. But the heart of the reset is a defense agreement that will let Britain be part of any joint arms procurement and pave the way for British companies such as BAE and Rolls-Royce to take part in a 150 billion euro, that's about $167 billion, program to rearm Europe. The EU Commission President Ursula von der Leyen said in a statement, "At a time of global instability and when our continent faces the greatest threat it has for generations, we in Europe stick together." Finally, an update from last week's report on seabed mining by the Trump administration, which are planned to take place in international waters. My thanks to listener Scott, who has pointed me to an article in the Scientific American, which reports on seafloor mining tests being conducted offshore from Papua New Guinea in the South Pacific. The article's author attempted to determine the legality of the mining operations, but ran into a brick wall with the Papua New Guinea authorities. What is clear, the author writes, is that deep sea mining on a commercial scale will begin soon somewhere. Norway, the Cook Islands, Japan, and Sweden have approved deep sea mining in their exclusive economic zones. On the other side are Germany, Spain, and Chile, which have called for a pause because of uncertainty about the environmental impact. Palau and Fiji have advocated for a moratorium, and France wants an outright ban. A new deep sea mining code is expected to be ready by year's end. And that's the Global Citizen International Digest for the week. I'm Mel Gertov. Thanks for listening, and take good care.
You are listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm joined today by Laura Grimes, the Executive Director at Oregon Arts Watch, to talk about some of the recent stories from that publication. Welcome to the show, Laura.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you for being here. The first story I want to ask you about is called Miller Foundation Kicks Off Round 2 of its $1.5 million Artist Spark Awards. Now, this is a pretty unique grant opportunity for artists. How does this all work?
The James F. and Marion L. Miller Foundation is selecting their second year of Spark Awards, which is a three-year pilot project to award $25,000 each to 60 Oregon artists to advance their careers. So this year's 20 grants will go to literary and media artists. The program kicked off last year with grants to 20 performing artists, and next year's grants will go to visual artists. So these awards are meant for mid-career artists, those who have established their careers and are expecting to have many more years of creating art, There are specific requirements. Applicants must be at least 30 years of age by December 31st, 2025. They must have been a resident in Oregon for at least the past 5 years and must have been a practicing artist of 7 years or more. There are other requirements as well. And like you mentioned, the Spark Awards are distinctive because they are given to individual artists with virtually no strings attached. It's meant to allow for flexibility so that they can further their practices. The Miller Foundation teamed up with the Oregon Community Foundation and the Oregon Legislature to give away $52 billion over 3 years to the struggling arts and culture community. So this is a part of that in the middle of that 3 years. And this is really helpful because there's been such a severe slash in federal funding, which included rescinding millions of dollars nationally for grants that have been awarded to artists. So it's the arts and culture community has just really faced a lot of adversity, and it's still trying to recover from the pandemic. So this is really meant as a shot in the arm. These are just really remarkable. I think last year they had almost 300 applications, and they picked 20 artists for that. So this is a really special opportunity. The deadline to apply is July 2nd, and you can find all that information at millerfound.org.
I was very impressed to learn sort of the variety of things that artists might be able to spend the money on, whether that's for supplies for a project or even on rent and food for the period that they want to be creating.
Yep, travel costs, whatever they might need. I can't talk enough about how grants like this are just so important. We received some grants like this that really are shot in the arm. Like there's this validation. It kind of increases your confidence. It really kind of, which infuses everything that you do then. You know, you sit up straighter, you dream bigger, you're able to really do better creativity because you've been recognized and validated in some way. So these grants are really important.
ArtsWatch has another story out called Trails End Art Association in Gearheart, a fellowship of artists. The club, which offers an egalitarian welcome to artists ranging from painters to needleworks to gourd crafters, is celebrating its 75th anniversary. This one is by Lori Tobias. What can you tell me about the Trails End Art Association?
I love this kind of story that really gets to the heart of a community, what it means for people to gather and have fellowship, like it mentioned. So the Trails End Art Association is in Gearheart, which is just north of Seaside, and the whole community has fewer than 2,000 people, almost 2,000 people, but not quite. So it's a warm and welcoming community. This particular Trails End Art Association has 62 members. They pay an annual fee, and it includes, you know, being able to show in their gallery and have discounts on classes. It has space for them to create art. It's actually a kind of a fun space. It's in a former schoolhouse, which was built in 1903, and it was moved to its current location. It might have had a history as an art gallery at some point. It was believed to be used as an additional classroom and a gymnasium for the Gearheart School. And they've made accommodations for, you know, people who have mobility challenges, so that's really an accessible space. So as part of their 75th anniversary, which they're celebrating this next year, they're going to be dedicating a free little art gallery there, which I think is really sweet, and their anniversary celebration will continue this next year with an art walk in July and a judged show in August. September, I believe they have tickets for a cheese and wine tasting, and in December they will have another fundraiser. So they have activities planned to celebrate their 75 years, and I like these stories just because it shows what a community spirit can do, something that's really positive and supportive. I like that.
I was interested to read about how much the organization relies on its volunteers to take on such a variety of roles, and that they've overcome a sort of back and forth about what constitutes fine art, what ought to be the purpose in their organization.
Yeah, I like it when people struggle with ideas like that, like what is inclusivity? And in fact, in the art world, it's often discussing what is fine art, what is craft. I think the fact that people are making things, and it's the process of making art that's actually important, at least it is to me. I know people have various ideas about what makes an art practice, but I like how they have refined their process over the years, and they've decided to make it inclusive. They have gourd making and sewing and quilting, and I like any kind of creative practice, and so I really appreciate that this community welcomes all forms of art.
There's another story from Arts Watch that published Wednesday called I Am an American Live, Telling Tales from Many Cultures. It discusses and reviews a recent storytelling and music performance at the Reser in Beaverton. Talk to me about this one.
The Immigrant Story holds these live events a few times a year. They're free and open to the public. This was really remarkable. I was at this event, and it had four storytellers. One was from Malaysia, one was from Afghanistan, one was from Vietnam, and one was adopted from Nepal. And they all had really interesting stories of conflict, of, you know, they were, some of them were harrowing. They were tragic. They were really, really heartfelt. But they also recounted resilience and determination. They were uplifting and hopeful and inspiring. I think it's really important because these stories from immigrants are our shared American stories. We all come from immigrants at some point. And so it was really heartwarming to hear about our shared humanity. Even though we don't necessarily share those same experiences, I think we can relate to and identify with people who experience hardship. We can empathize and we can gain better understanding. I think it's really important now that we have these stories that push back against any type of discrimination or persecution, immigrants. It's important to understand that there are people behind that. And so what are their stories? How do they come to the United States? What have their experiences been? I really appreciated their bravery and courage in sharing them. And they're really moving. They're fascinating stories. It was really well done. So they do hold these events occasionally. And Immigrant Story has a lot of other programming as well. They regularly print profiles of immigrants, so they have these interviews that they do. They have a podcast. Right now they've been focusing on some food carts that are run by immigrants, and they hold events. I know that they have a yearly event at Willamette University, for instance. They have curriculum for teachers to share with students about how to interview people to be able to learn their stories. So they have all kinds of really remarkable work. They have a book that's out. Really, the Immigrant Story just does really quality, positive work to share with everybody about people's stories, people's human stories.
If our listeners are interested in reading any of the stories that we talked about today, what's the best way for them to do that?
You can find all these stories and more at Oregon Arts Watch at orartswatch.org.
Any final thoughts before we wrap up?
I don't.
Listeners, sponsors, stations count on you, not Arbitron. So when you push their buttons, you get radio that turns you on.
Hi there, this is Ann Feeney, and you are listening to listener-supported community radio, KVU FM in Portland.
tuned in to KBOO Portland, 90.7 on your FM dial.
To kick off Pride Month and celebrate Portland's LGBTQ+ community, KBOO will be hosting Queer Joy Fest on Friday, June 6th from 6 to 10 p.m. at the Foster